O Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. It's hard not to like Eve. She's bright and articulate, a very good theologian, and not afraid to face serpents single-handedly. What's not to like about that? She tests out what's been handed over to her, refusing to accept without question whatever is thrown her way. And when she is caught red-handed, she doesn't waste a lot of words coming up with too many defensive excuses. The serpent tricked me, and I ate. Short and to the point, Eve owns her mistakes. Yet early in the life of the church, Eve was given a more sinister reputation. The Greek Apocalypse of Moses, a Greek-Jewish text that didn't make it into the Bible, has Eve confessing to her descendants that the fall came about as the result of a sexual relationship between her and the tempter. Somehow the devil gets introduced into the story, even though there is no devil in the Genesis account. And rather than knowingly eating the fruit, as Adam does in the Genesis account, in this one he's tricked and exclaims, "O evil woman, why have you wrought evil among us?" 1 Timothy, a text that did make it into the Bible, makes a similar argument. Adam was not deceived, some follower of Paul, writing in his name, argues, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing, provided they continue in faith and love and holiness with modesty. It is comforting to me to realize that Paul himself wrote almost the opposite in Romans. But it is troubling to see how much the Christian tradition has slandered Eve as the sexually promiscuous woman who leads the upright Adam to sin. It is hard to leave all of that baggage behind as some version of Eve as the root of the problem shows up in all kinds of places, from Snow White to the recent release of The Jungle Book, which I saw a couple of weeks ago. In that movie, the serpent, some kind of giant tree boa, lulls the young boy to near death in the sultry voice of Scarlett Johansson. A slandered Eve and the serpent fused perfectly into one. Thanks a lot, Disney. If we are able to come to the text without all of that baggage, it is hard not to like Eve. What is the big deal about her sin? It's not like she commits any of the biggies. There's no murder, there's no stealing, or even lying involved. The serpent asks her what God said about the tree, and she repeats back God's words almost verbatim. She doesn't do anything other than question the truth and then act on her conclusions, something that a lot of people in this congregation pride themselves in doing and in teaching to our children, especially even our daughters. I mean, if we had a parking lot for this church, there would be more than a few cars with the same well-behaved women rarely make history bumper sticker plastered on them. Even though you won't find any language about anyone falling from anything or to anything in this text, that is the lesson that we've taken from all of this. Disobedience is the beginning of the fall. Do what you're told, follow the rules set down by God, don't ask questions. Enjoy your freedom within the boundaries that God sets down, but do not try to exceed them. Don't try to be like God. It is not a bad lesson for human beings most of the time. Trying to make yourself like God has serious consequences. Just ask the victims of people playing God in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or Pearl Harbor, or Auschwitz. Just ask people who flee from the violence of people who put themselves in the seat of God in El Salvador, in Mexico, and Guatemala, or Syria, or South Sudan. We human beings sometimes confuse the power that knowledge brings with the right to exercise that power. Eve's decision is a warning about the consequences of exceeding limits put down by God. Knowledge, like all forms of power, is amoral. And some forms of knowledge we human beings are just not ready to handle. Maybe some forms of knowledge we'll never be able to fully handle. And yet so ingrained in us is our belief that all knowledge necessarily leads to good that whenever the poets or the screenwriters or the novelists raise alarms, they are dismissed as anti-intellectual, Luddites who won't get with the program, irrational, apocalyptic folk who fear advancement. No, knowledge is power, but power always needs direction, values, and limits. I kind of wish that God had just said that to Eve and to us. Eve, if you eat the fruit, it's going to cause you a lot of unnecessary trouble. You've got everything that you need in the garden. Trust me, you do not want to disrupt that. Or even something like, Eve, I'm asking you to trust me on this fruit business. I can't explain why it's a bad idea without you experiencing it. And once you've experienced it, there is no going back. But God tells them instead, if they eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they will die. And that is not what happens. They eat the fruit, and then they realize that they are naked. Now, I realize that for some of us, being seen naked might seem as bad as dying. John Calvin said as much in his commentary on this passage. "We cannot behold a man without a sense of shame," the father of the Reformed tradition wrote in the mid-1500s. "Yet at the sight of an ass, a dog, or an ox, no such feeling will be produced." This is what our greatest theologians bring to us. But the truth is that the only death that Adam and Eve seem to experience in the moment of their new knowledge is the death of their complete trust in God. That is the only real change that happens when they eat the fruit. The knowledge Adam and Eve received doesn't seem to make them any wiser. It only makes them ashamed. It is the shadow side of our insatiable desire always to know more. Knowing more doesn't always improve our garden. Knowing more sometimes means more anxiety, more pain, more hurt, not less. Knowing more sometimes makes our lives or our community or our world worse, not better. But still, we chase after truth, even when that truth is beyond our capacity to comprehend, even when our inability to handle that truth destroys what is good about our living. Maybe that is why God threatens something much worse than what actually happens. Maybe God knows that we will never be satisfied with childlike trust, even though living and dying in this world makes that the only satisfying option. We want to know more. When Lulu Wong's grandmother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, she found it inconceivable that her family didn't want her grandmother to find out that she was sick. Her grandmother was 80 years old, was given 3 months to live, and her family decided not to tell her. Her grandmother lives in China, where it is customary for doctors to give bad news to family members rather than directly to patients. Her grandmother's sister, who received the bad news, was so worried that her sister would fall into depression, stop eating, and give up, that she decided not to tell her. The whole family agreed to lie, which was almost too much for Lulu, raised in the West, to accept. They all traveled to China, telling Lulu's grandmother that they were making the trip for another family member's wedding, even though they all knew that they were going to tell her goodbye. Troubled, deeply troubled by this lie, Lulu went to her mother, who informed her that her grandmother would be happy that they were lying to her for her own sake. Otherwise, her mother said, why would your grandmother have done the same thing to your grandfather? Still wanting to know more, Lulu uncovered yet more secrets. Her grandmother had endured treatment for breast cancer for 9 years, but told no one in the family except her sister. While they had been lying to her, she had been lying to them to protect them. Lulu went through with the lie, and 3 years after the doctor first diagnosed her grandmother with 3 months to live, she was still around, doing well for an 83-year-old. In her reflection on This American Life, Lulu confesses that just like about all other Americans, she believes it is every person's right to know if they are going to die. But at the same time, she wonders if not knowing is what has kept her grandmother alive. There's an old Chinese belief called Shongji, she says. Chong means to rinse out, and ji is joy. So Shongji is the belief that you can wash away a misfortune with joy. That is, she said, essentially what we did. Eve, like a lot of us, chooses to know. And I can't say that any one of us can or will make a different choice. Given the choice between knowing more about who we are or knowing less, I know which choice I will make almost every time. I take the fruit. The temptation is to want to know everything as God knows it, to see everything as God sees it. That is what the serpent promises will happen to anyone who eats the fruit. It's why Eve, the mother of all living, reaches out to taste and see. It is that human trait that spurs us to know ourselves, to build new things, to solve problems, to innovate, to grow. But it is also what undergirds our deep anxiety about not having enough or not being enough, as well as our deep fear that death swallows us up, so we'd better resist it for ourselves at all cost, sometimes with a great cost to others. It is that fear that is played out in everything from our presidential politics to our college admissions rat race to our greedy use of energy to the drug wars in our streets and our fearful reactions to it. We play God with knowledge we continue to use in ways that are harmful to our world and to each other. And maybe that is a better lesson that we should take from Eve and from Adam, since both choose to eat the fruit. Not the lesson that questioning God is somehow the root of all sin. That lesson has been so abused by the church and monarchs and terrorists and powers through the centuries that we should be wise enough by now to resist it. No, rather the truth that we can't pretend to ever handle the world as God sees it. We can't even handle the truth of ourselves as God sees us. What God sees leads God to fight for our futures even more. What we see leads us to shame about who we really are. And we can try to walk through this life without finally relinquishing ourselves to God. It is possible to do this, but it is miserable to try to put ourselves always in the driver's seat. Trust, it seems to me, is the hardest of all faith lessons to learn. Like anybody else, I've had to learn that kind of trust so many times in my life, going into the CT tube, then under the knife, stepping onto a plane, especially one that I don't get to pilot, participating in civil disobedience, letting my daughters out of my sight for moments, then hours, then days, and finally eternity. Not clenching onto the future of our church so tightly as if our community is my project or even our project instead of God's. Trusting my partner in marriage even when I know she sees me as I am, not as I hope to be seen. It is a hard path to choose. And yet God always puts it there for us. Maybe because of Eve and Adam, it is a choice instead of a mandate, an option instead of part of our design. It is the path that God offers to us on this side of Eden. And it is the one that makes hope and love possible in the face of knowledge that drives many to fear and death. It is this good path that God keeps offering to us.